From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lee Maynard's first novel, Crumb, is a coming-of-age novel set in the poor West Virginia town where he grew up. It's banned in a state-run store. Those people from West Virginia who hate the novel are offended not only by the sex and expletives, but by sentences like this one: "Life in Crumb was one gay, mad whirl of abject ignorance." But those people who love the novel love his writing and his love for West Virginia, even if it's only expressed between the lines. Maynard has written a new sequel called Screaming with the Cannibals. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about growing up in Crumb and getting out. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Britney Spears' new album, In the Zone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. John Allen Muhammad was sentenced to death today for his role in the Washington area sniper slayings. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
As he has been throughout his trial in the killing of 53-year-old Dean Myers, Muhammad was stoic as the death sentences were read. He shook hands with his attorneys before burly deputies escorted him out of courtroom 10 for the final time. Prosecutor Paul Ebert told reporters afterwards there were certain cases that deserved the death penalty, and this was one of them. Defense attorney Peter Greenspun said he was bitterly disappointed with the sentence.
What is more unseemly than the Attorney General of the United States saying, "We're going to go to Virginia where Mr. Muhammad will be killed"?
The case will automatically be appealed. Judge Leroy Millette could reduce the sentence to life in prison when he makes his formal sentencing in February, but that scene is unlikely. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
In nearby Chesapeake, the trial continues of Muhammad's alleged partner in the shootings, teenager Lee Boyd Malvo. He could also face the death penalty if convicted. The prosecution rested its case today, and the defense began presenting its evidence. This morning, President Bush signed into law a bill to authorize the spending of more than $401 billion on defense. He said the money sends the message that at a time of challenge, the nation stands with its military.
Those who risk their lives for our liberty deserve to be fairly paid and fairly treated. And this bill keeps those commitments.
After signing the bill, the president flew to Fort Carson, Colorado, to speak with two soldiers and their families. That base was home to 28 soldiers who died in Iraq since the president declared an end to major combat May 1st. Sprint Corporation has announced it's laying off 2,000 workers, part of a continuing effort to cut costs. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
The 2,000 jobs cut represent about 3% of Sprint's 68,000-person workforce. The layoffs will affect workers in the company's local, long-distance, and wireless divisions. About 400 of the jobs will be cut from Sprint's corporate headquarters in Overland Park, Kansas. Sprint says the layoffs are part of an organizational restructuring. In September, the company said it intended to cut expenses by more than $1 billion over the next 3 years by consolidating and streamlining some operations. Sprint is the nation's number four U.S. long-distance company, and it's been struggling to cut costs in an increasingly competitive industry. It's laid off more than 20,000 workers in the past 2 years. Last month, Sprint announced that it lost $498 million in the third quarter, compared with a $518 million profit a year ago. Greg Allen, NPR News, Kansas City.
Stocks rallied on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 119 points to 97.47. The Nasdaq closed up 53 points to 1947. Trading was active. This is NPR News. Boeing officials said today they fired the company's chief financial officer. According to the statement, Michael Sears was dismissed for unethical conduct in connection with the hiring of a senior Air Force procurement official who was also let go after being on the job for less than a year. Sears reportedly had spoken with her about working for Boeing while she was still working for the government. At least 36 people were killed and nearly 200 people were injured in a fire at a dormitory for foreign students in southwest Moscow today. Peter Thackeray reports from the Russian capital.
The five-story dormitory of the People's Friendship University in Moscow was engulfed in flames for more than 3 hours. The dormitory was packed with almost 300 foreign students from Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Those who couldn't make it out of the burning building by foot were forced to jump out of windows from the upper floors. Hospital officials are saying the injured admitted are suffering from carbon monoxide poisoning, burns and broken limbs. According to Moscow's mayor, Yuri Lushkov, the most likely cause of the fire was an electrical short circuit in a student room. However, a criminal investigation has been opened and authorities are not ruling out the possibility of an arson attack. The university was founded in 1960 by Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev to offer a Marxist curriculum to students from developing nations. For NPR News, I'm Peter Thackeray in Moscow.
Songwriter Teddy Randazzo has died at his home in Orlando, Florida. A cause of death has not been released. He had suffered a heart attack 20 years ago. Randazzo was the co-author of more than 600 songs. His hits included Going Out of My Head, Hurt So Bad, and It's Gonna Take a Miracle. Teddy Randazzo was 68 years old. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, a proud sponsor of NPR and presenting In America from director Jim Sheridan, opens in select theaters November 26th.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lee Maynard's semi-autobiographical novel Crumb is set in Crumb, the small, dirt-poor West Virginia town where he grew up. The people of Crumb who know the book tend to love it or hate it. It's even banned in a state-run store. It was first published in 1988. In an introduction to the 2001 edition, Meredith Sue Willis writes that she asks why this foul-mouthed, sexist, scatological, hillbilly stereotyping novel is one of her all-time favorites. She finally answers that by saying, quote, "The book explores and explodes its stereotypes. It might also be called a love letter from a native son to his home place," unquote. But it sure doesn't read like a love letter. The main character is desperate to get out, and at the age of 18, he does. Crumb is a coming-of-age novel. The new sequel, Screaming with the Cannibals, describes his travels after hitchhiking out of Crumb. Lee Maynard now lives in New Mexico and does consulting work for nonprofits. His work has been published in the Washington Post and the Christian Science Monitor. He's an assignment writer for Reader's Digest. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of Crumb.
When I was growing up there, the population of Crumb, West Virginia, was 219 human beings, two subhumans, a few platoons of assorted dogs, at least one cat that I paid any attention to, a retarded mule, and a very vivid image of Crash Corrigan. At first, there were no whores, but later on, I got to watch one of them aching. Crumb, unincorporated, the road sign said, at the edge of town. It should have said, unnecessary. The place is located deep in the bowels of the Appalachians, on the bank of the Tug River, the urinary tract of the mountains. Across the flowing urine is Kentucky. Life in Crumb was one gay, mad whirl of abject ignorance, emotions spilling over emotions, sex spilling over love, and sometimes blood spilling over everything. The Korean War happened to be going on at the time, but it was something being fought in another world, and besides, who really gave a damn about all those gooks anyway? Our boys could handle them. Or so they said in the beer gardens. And what the hell were gooks? I'd never seen one. Or a nigger, or a Jew, or a wop. I had heard those names from some of the men who had been outside of West Virginia working in the steel mills of Pittsburgh and the factories of Detroit, but I didn't know what their names meant, and I had never seen any of those people.
That's Lee Maynard reading from his novel Crumb. Now, as you say, you grew up in an unincorporated town, which meant it didn't have what?
It didn't have anything. It unincorporated, as I understood it in those days, and I guess it's still that way, and it means it has no infrastructure. There's no town government. There's no police force. There's no fire department, no sidewalks, no streets, just a bunch of houses sort of stuck in an enclosed little area.
Did you realize that other places had sewer systems and police and water systems, sewage systems, all that stuff?
Oh, yeah, every now and then. We would be taken as kids to other towns, and I would actually see sidewalks. I remember the first time I ever went to Huntington, which is a relatively large city in West Virginia, and I saw a manhole cover, and I was amazed that there were actually tunnels and wires and pipes down below the street surface, because the only thing below the street surface where I lived was more street.
In the section that you just read, you call the Tug River the urinary tract of the mountains. What made it that?
In most of the villages, most of the small towns along the river in those days, I hasten to insert here that it's changed quite a bit. But back then, people lived on the riverbank, and the riverbank had two actual levels to it. There was the normal level where the river flowed, then the river would rise up into a flat. And when it was not on the flats, people would grow sugar cane and other small sort of crops down there. It's also where they threw the garbage. So you threw your garbage over the riverbank down on the flat. Twice a year, the river, like clockwork, would rise and carry it away. And one of our great entertainments in Crum was to sit on the riverbank and see what floated by. And you never knew what was going to happen.
Well, there's a scene in Crum where what's floating by is a dead and decaying horse. Did that happen to you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've remembered that for decades. I mean, this horse goes floating down. I have no idea how the horse got dead, but there was this one big eye sort of staring up at the sky, and it was and little kids looking at that. Well, I wasn't that little a kid, but young people looking at that, it made an impression. Still does.
It happens at a particularly inopportune time in your novel. <'Cause> the young man in your novel is eyeing a young woman, and things are about to happen between them when this dead horse floats by. Was the timing the same way in life?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's
God.
When you get in,
that's when amazing.
You, when you get your concentration destroyed, it might as well be by a dead horse.
Gives you something to talk about after the spell is broken.
Oh, it does. It does.
As we heard from your reading, there weren't any African-Americans or Jews or Italians in Crum when you were growing up. Did you know that they existed?
I did in sort of a tangential way. The only way I ever heard those people referred to was as I referred to them in the book. The people who lived in Crum and in southern West Virginia in particular in those days, they weren't too accepting. They were not really politically correct. And in the high school, when I misbehaved, they would send me to the library. The library was more of a glorified closet than anything else. They'd send me to the library. I discovered there were actually books in this room, and so I would read the books and got to enjoy doing that. So I misbehaved a lot, so I got sent to the library a lot. If you can imagine being sent to a library as punishment, that was sort of indicative of how it worked. And it was there that I found out there were other people and other places, and what the library really did was sort of build a fire under me in terms of wanting to leave and wanting to see other things.
So what were the early books you got your hands on where you thought, this is good?
Oh, I can give you a very specific example. There was a book called The Mysterious Island, and it was a sequel to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And I read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I enjoyed it greatly, but The Mysterious Island was a book I used to carry around in in an old backpack. In fact, I mentioned it in one of the books. That's all I had with me when I left town.
What did your friends think of you carrying around a book?
They made fun of it, actually. And one thing you didn't do in southern West Virginia in those days was you never said, gee, I'd like to be a writer. That was the equivalent to saying, I'd like to be a ballet dancer, or I would like to be an actor, or whatever. There were certain occupations that were legitimate and certain occupations that were just taken as jokes. And to have a hillbilly kid say, gee, I might like to be a writer, you never said that. It just wasn't something that you spent a lot of time talking about.
Was it because it's out of reach, or did it have like gay overtones?
Oh, very much so. Not only gay overtones, but tones of unreality. It's like, I might as well have wished to be president or an astronaut in the days when astronauts were, I don't know, cartoon characters. So you didn't, if you wanted to live through the day without bleeding, you didn't. you really didn't talk too much about that sort of stuff.
How often did you bleed?
Oh, regularly. To tell you the truth, Terry, I just couldn't seem to stay out of the way of it. I mean, I'll give a specific example. In the first paragraph that I just read from Crum, I said there was a very vivid image of Crash Corrigan, and I wonder how many people out there actually know who Crash Corrigan was. He was a B-Western movie star, and I originally said a very vivid image of the Lone Ranger in the original copy, and I later changed it because Crash was greatly more obscure, and I sort of love that. But one time in Crum, I sort of hinted to a group of guys that the Lone Ranger wasn't actually real, that he was a character created by some guy like I wanted to be, some guy who told lies for a living, and he created the Lone Ranger. And I took one of the worst wallopings I had ever taken, because to sort of undeify an icon like the Lone Ranger was pretty dangerous where I lived.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lee Maynard, and he is the author of two novels. The first, Crum, is about growing up in a very, very small town in West Virginia. And the second novel, which has just been published, is called Screaming with the Cannibals, and that's about his life shortly after leaving Crum. You write that there were three things that most every kid in Crum High School had in common: poverty, ignorance, and sex. You don't use the word sex, but we can't say the word that you do use, so we'll keep it to the word sex.
All right. Okay.
So, how old were you and your friends when you started having sex?
First grade.
First grade?
Well, look, you have no toys, so you play with the toys that you have. I mean, you're out behind the school, or you're hiking around the little road, and there's this big culvert that goes under, and you discover that you can sit in this culvert and make funny noises, and it echoes along the culvert. You never think about the fact that a ranger can get washed out of there. And then you find out other kids sit in the culvert, and you talk, and you play, and you wrestle, and you scratch. And as little kids, you experiment. I don't know if you could really call it sex, but in the sense of, watching an X-rated movie. But certainly there was a lot of body exploration, I'll show you mine if you'll show me yours kind of thing among very, very young kids.
With boys and with girls?
Oh, yes.
At what point did you learn about the connection between sex and pregnancy?
I'm really not sure that I know, Terry. I know that very early in high school, there were a lot of kids who would get pregnant. And, a girl would suddenly have a slightly altered figure, and then she wouldn't be in school anymore. And, in fact, you would never see her again. I mean, she would literally go away, as far as we knew, forever. So I think we connected it up pretty early, probably by what would be called middle school. We knew pretty much what the score was. I don't know if we knew how to fix it, but we knew what the score was.
Right. I have to say, I felt so sorry for the girls who you knew, because they seem to not necessarily get a lot of respect from the boys, and also there was such curiosity about their bodies and everything that, they'd get a lot of attention for sex, but not necessarily for other things.
Well, that's probably true, although, and I have been taken to task a number of times by women who felt that the girls in the book were denigrated in many ways. Actually, and I suppose this is sort of self-defense, when I look at the characters in the book, and when I look at the characters in Cannibals, the girls are the only ones who have a clue, really, about what's going on and what's happening. The guys just sort of go from day to day, sort of living a life that many of them may not have wanted to live. But it's the girls who kind of have it figured out. The character of Yvonne, for example, or as we would say in West Virginia, Yvonne. The character of Yvonne is one of the only people who really knows what she's got to trade with and how to use it to get the hell out of Crum, and she did that. And as you know, she showed up again in Cannibals in a very significantly different role. But I've had some kind of literary types tell me that that they like the way the women are treated, and the fact that in Cannibals, maybe he's growing up a little bit, maybe he's a little more understanding. He does get a little older, but I think he has a better relationship with women in Cannibals than certainly he had in Crum.
My guest is Lee Maynard, author of the novel Crum and the new sequel, Screaming with the Cannibals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Lee Maynard, and he's the author of two novels, Crumb, which is about growing up in a very small town in West Virginia, and Screaming with the Cannibals, his new novel, which is about what his life was like shortly after he left Crumb. We talked a little bit about reading and how you used to get sent to the school library as punishment, and you discovered a lot of books there. How did you learn to write? I mean, what was the kind of writing that was expected of you in school, and how did you start writing beyond that?
Well, I don't, you know, Terry, I really don't know how it all started, but definitely I started writing in early in high school, and I would just start putting things down on paper. I suppose recording thoughts might be a way to describe it. And when I would go back and read these things, I would understand that they weren't good, that I had written something that was perhaps even incomprehensible. And I didn't want to write incomprehensible things. But I knew very, very early that even though I couldn't sort of broadcast it or I wasn't good at it, that I was a writer, that I could actually get pleasure out of putting these words down. The whole idea is that essentially I'm just a storyteller. I'm not out to save anybody's soul. And as you know from reading Crumb and Cannibals, I certainly don't go in that direction.
Your father was a teacher. What did he teach?
He taught English. But in those days, a teacher taught everything. You taught what you were assigned to teach. You know, if you had a teaching certificate, they sort of somehow assumed that that was an across-the-board management of various disciplines. And so my father, you could find him teaching health or history or English or math. I mean, it all depended on what they needed you to do. They didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to whether you were good at teaching that particular piece of material.
Where did he grow up?
Right where he died. He died about 500 yards from where he was born, and in southern Wayne County in West Virginia.
So the same county you grew up in?
The same county I grew up in. The Maynards moved into that county in 1790 in a place called Kaya's Creek at that time. I think it's now called Kaya'sville. And they're still there. I don't know that you could get them out of there with a bulldozer.
Did you ever ask yourself... I'm sure you did. What is it that made your father, even though he had a master's degree, what made him want to stay in Wayne County, whereas when you were in your teens, you knew you had to get out?
I have absolutely no explanation for that, except that there are two kinds of, and I'll limit this to West Virginia, there are two kinds of West Virginians. There are those who grew up there, who love it there, who would never leave there. You couldn't pull them out of there with a truck. And there are a few like me that I always felt. Did you ever hear that thing by Mom where he said some men are born out of their time and place? They long for a place they know not. They're strangers in their homeland. That's a paraphrase, but that's pretty close. Mm-hmm. And that's what I felt like. I felt like all along that there's something weird going on here. You know, there's been this huge accident, and I'm it. And I need to be someplace else. But my father certainly never felt that way. I think my father was probably in his 50s before he began taking vacations outside of West Virginia.
Hmm. Let me read the opening quote that you have, or the opening. I don't know. I never remember what you call this. This is the quote or the phrase that precedes the actual text of the book.
Okay.
When all the goodbyes are said, I want to be the one who is leaving, and it's going to be good to be gone. That, I guess, sums up how you were feeling growing up.
That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
In fact, Terry, that's the whole bloody book in a nutshell. I mean, I wrote that line, and I must admit, I don't know what you call that either.
It's right, just okay.
Words in the front of the book, you know. But I always – did you ever go to a – like a family reunion, and there's some folks there that you haven't seen for a while, and they come in, and you have a good time, and you enjoy them, and then it's over, and they leave, and you watch them leave. You watch them drive away or fly away or whatever, and there's this sort of, I always got this sort of sinking feeling, like, wait, I'm supposed to be the one that's doing that.
Uh-huh.
But I never was, until I got to be about 14 or 15. And I always wanted to be the one who was leaving.
How did you do it? How did you actually get out?
I ran away. Started running away from home when I was 14. And my parents would never admit that. They'd say, well, he's visiting relatives. But I was actually just gone. I was on the road. I was a big kid. I probably stopped growing, Terry, when I was maybe 15 or 16. I'm kind of an oversized guy. I probably weighed 200 pounds then. And so I didn't look like I was 14. I don't think I ever looked like I was 14. So I could hitchhike with relative ease. And back in those days, hitchhiking wasn't that big a deal. Everybody did it. So I would go away, and then I found out that I wanted to learn more things, and I found out it was expensive to go to schools where you didn't live. And so I would always rotate back to West Virginia and go to school and then run away again, and kept that up for years.
Would you be welcome when you returned home?
Yeah, it was sort of like if you don't really discuss it, it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
yep.
you know how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother would say, oh, you're back from your uncle's. And sometimes that was true. My uncle lived over in Ohio, and I would go over and he would put me to work. I was essentially, when I run away, I was an itinerant farm worker. I would sort of travel around with folks who took cut hay and made hay and picked apples and that kind of thing. I think we made, 50 cents an hour, I think, is what we were paid to do that. And after a while, I'd get tired of that, and I'd go back to school, and eventually kind of wormed my way through.
My guest is Lee Maynard, author of the novel Crumb and the new sequel, Screaming with the Cannibals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Art of the Bookplate, an illustrated history and celebration with a foreword by George Plimpton, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, every Monday is Doc Day, documentaries all day, with a television premiere at 9 p.m., listings at sundancechannel.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Exact Same Moon, 50 Acres and a Family, by Jean Marie Laskus, author of 50 Acres and a Poodle. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with novelist Lee Maynard about coming of age in Appalachia. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Britney Spears' new CD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lee Maynard, the author of Crumb, a novel about coming of age in a small, poor Appalachian town. Crumb is the town that Maynard grew up in. The novel was first published in 1988, and a new edition was published in 2001. Now Maynard has written a sequel called Screaming with the Cannibals. Your new novel, Screaming with the Cannibals, is a sequel to your novel Crumb. The first one's about growing up in West Virginia. The second is about leaving West Virginia. And the title, Screaming with the Cannibals, relates to a sentence from Crumb. And the sentence is about how, growing up, you were told never to swim the Tug River to Kentucky because Kentucky folks ate their young. They were cannibals. And in Screaming with the Cannibals, there's actually a scene in which you're screaming at a revival meeting in Kentucky with people from Kentucky. Were the people of Kentucky the monsters you were told to avoid?
Oh, of course not. I mean, we were told that adults in Crumb would tell you anything to keep you out of that river.
Oh, was that the point?
Oh, that was the whole point, yeah. They really had nothing against the people in Kentucky. Well, they did have something against the people in Kentucky. They had something against people outside of Crumb. So, they, you know,
all these something against the people in Crumb from
that's Well, yeah, I mean, we all have to look down on somebody. So, I mean, and everybody looks down on West Virginia. So, I'm quite proud of that. I love being there where people say, well, what's going on down there? And lo and behold, it's me. But in Crumb, they would tell you anything to keep you out of that bloody river. I mean, they did not want you swimming with light bulbs and garbage, you know, and dead horses and other bits of unidentified body parts floating down this river. So naturally we did. I mean, good heavens, if you tell a bunch of kids like that, don't do this, you know bloody well they're going to do that. And so we did. But the people in Kentucky turned out to be, as I think I said in Cannibals, pretty much like the people in West Virginia. In fact, I was in an airport, Washington Airport, I've forgotten which one now, and I missed the plane. I'm sitting with a guy, and he said, you know how you do, it's late at night, and you're sitting there talking. He said, where are you from? And I said, well, I grew up in West Virginia, and I lived a long time in a little town called Crumb. And the guy just broke into laughter. And he said, I'm from Inez, Kentucky. And Inez is probably the closest town across the river to Crumb. He said, let me tell you a story. He said, when I was a kid, they used to tell us not to go on that river because if you got over on the West Virginia side, those people would kill you and eat you. And I'm thinking, well, you know, it's all Appalachia. It's all Appalachia.
There are scenes in both novels at revival meetings. What was church like when you were growing up?
It was pretty fundamental. I have witnessed, I was in a Baptist church. Now, the Baptists in those days, they were fairly conservative folks. They certainly had heard of Jewish people, although I doubt if they had seen any. So as a religion, they really didn't know anything about that. They were highly, highly suspect of Catholics. And they knew that all Catholics kept guns in the basements of their churches, and so they could take over when the time came. And they weren't too damn sure about Presbyterians and Methodists. So going to those churches was sort of an experience, and quite honestly, it was one that I did not particularly enjoy. Was kicked out of the Baptist church one time during a service, at an evangelistic service, which I'd gone to because my mother asked me to go, so I went. And I have sort of stood on the stump outside the old Clapboard church and witnessed Pentecostal services through the crack, scared to death of actually going inside. And it was something that it didn't taste like I thought religion should taste like. And I didn't begin to understand what organized religion could be and perhaps should be until I left Crumb and got down into the South and then later on to the West.
What did you discover?
I discovered religion was joyful. The religion that I had seen practiced was not a joyful thing. I think the phrase, fear God, I mean, I'm not sure I wanted a God that I was just terribly afraid of all the time.
Was the focus always on sin?
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness, yes. And You know, among those sins were wearing lipstick, a dress that didn't cover your knees, or in some cases your ankles, playing sports, smoking, certainly drinking, and coveting thy neighbor's wife was right up there on the top of the list, not to mention just abject sins such as fornication. So there were a lot of ways to go to hell, and I used to think, well, there are so many ways to go to hell, I don't know how one actually gets to heaven ever.
Your first novel, Crumb, was not well received in the town of Crumb. It was censored in some places. Who censored it?
It was it got actually censored or banned, Terry, in the republication stage. When Crumb first came out, it came out to very mediocre reviews. The stir that it created was basically a hometown or home county stir. Wayne County has a town in it called Canova. I also used to live there, and of course that's right next to Huntington, which is a fairly good-sized town, and you know, has real live newspapers and all that sort of thing. And so I was taken to task for basically telling a story that I thought was pretty much the truth. So when Crumb was republished, then people realized that this book was not going to die and there must be some truth in it. And so that's when it began to get noticed from places outside of West Virginia and Appalachia. The reaction to the republishing was by and large extremely positive. And while there were still some people, I have one lady who's, I ask your indulgence here in not using her name, but there's one lady in Crumb who is my most dedicated enemy. She would do she would do anything if she could simply burn all the copies of Crumb. And bless her heart, she's entitled to that opinion, and I wouldn't change that for the world. But there's still folks down there who they're not exactly fans of mine.
So was it banned by the school system, by the school?
Oh, I suppose I should have spoken to that. When the republished edition came out, it did create a lot of attention. And actually, there's a place in West Virginia called Tamarack. And what it is, it's a state-owned facility that sells only products made in West Virginia. And it's a wonderful facility. I mean, it's just everybody should go by and see this place. And actually, I was driving by there. My wife and I were driving by there. And we went in, and lo and behold, there was a bookstore. And it sold books only by West Virginians, but not Crumb. And so when I asked the lady if she'd ever heard of this book, she kind of shied away from the question and said, well, we don't sell that book. And, you know, there are people who can say the word that with such emphasis that you know exactly what's going on. So we started tracking down. Lo and behold, it, in fact, had been banned from the state facility. So the book was banned by state government, but not by all of state government, because the republishing was done by the university, which is very much a part of state government. So just one of those odd things where some people felt, well, this is not a book we can sell to families with little kids.
You've been telling us a little bit about your life, and, you know, from the early part of your life, I would not have guessed that you would go on to, you know, go to college and become a writer. You know, you grew up in this incredibly small town. You went to a school that had an outhouse and not a toilet, judging from the novel.
That's right.
You know, you ran away from home when you were a teenager. You came back, but you were not exactly heading toward the halls of academe. Not in a straight line, anyways. So, how did you end up getting to the point where you went to college and then became a writer?
I think, Terry, there came a point in my life when I realized that I wanted to do some things that required me to be more educated. I was going to say sophisticated. I don't think I've ever in my entire life been taken as sophisticated, but I knew that I needed more education if I were going to do these things and get out of them what I wanted to get out of them. I needed to know more about the world and more about higher levels of intellect than I did. I would come home. My father would come home from school. He'd be so tired. We didn't talk. We talked very little in our family. I talked to my grandmother who was a great storyteller, far more than I ever talked to my own family about writing and storytelling and that sort of thing. So there was just a point where I realized that if I did not seek out more abject learning, that I was going to get left behind in some places where I did not want to be. And to me, it was another way of escaping locations like Crum, that I could, if I were more educated, I had more options. It was just that simple. And I don't know when that occurred to me, but I was probably still in high school when I realized that this was not the end of it. We have to keep going here.
What was the very first piece that you wrote that was published?
I wrote a piece called The Rock, and I still have it. It was published in some little newspaper back in West Virginia, and it was a kid. I mean, it was one of these terrible things. I mean, it was a kid on a sitting on a hillside in West Virginia, and down below the hillside was a road, and across the road was a railroad track, which was a scene right out of Crum. And we used to sit up on those hillsides and find round, I'll say saucer-like rocks, but actually they were more plate-sized, and we'd roll them down the hill. And, you know, after about 10 yards, this rock had the velocity of a cannon, and it weighed about 30 pounds, and it's just ripping down this hillside. And so the story was the kid is up there, and he rolls it down, and it hits a car, and the car veers off into the railroad track and causes a train wreck. And at the end of the story, the kid simply walks away because he hasn't a clue what else to do from there. And that was the first thing I think that was ever published. And it was total fiction, total fiction.
And it was published as fiction too, right? Not as a report.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely. I never made any, in fact, the only nonfiction sort of career-wise was I still write for Reader's Digest. And you don't ever try to get a word of fiction into the Reader's Digest. It's all documented, and so that's where I do my more journalistic stuff, is with those folks. And the rest of the time, I just happily tell lies, just as many as I can tell.
My guest is Lee Maynard, author of the novel Crum and the new sequel Screaming with the Cannibals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lee Maynard. He's the author of two novels. His novel, Crum, first published in 1988 and subsequently republished, is about his life growing up in a very small town in West Virginia. His newly published novel, Screaming with the Cannibals, is about his life shortly after he left Crum as a teenager. How did you meet your wife? You've been married over 40 years.
Oh, yes. I was stationed in a tiny little military establishment in western New York State. It was near a town called Geneva, and her father was the police commissioner of Geneva.
You were stationed in the military?
I was in the military. Mm-hmm. I never got out of the States in the mm-hmm. military. Mm-hmm. But I was a criminal investigator, and I came into town, and I went into a sporting goods store, and it was absolutely classic upstate New York midwinter weather, snow up to the gunnels, wind howling down the streets. And I basically went in this place to kind of escape the weather. And there was this woman in there. And that was the start of that. And less than 3 months later, we were married.
I guess it worked out.
It worked out. I think it'll last. You know, I have to tell you, every morning when I wake up and she's still there, I'm totally amazed. I'm just totally amazed.
Is there anything where you live now near Santa Fe that reminds you of Crum, West Virginia, where you grew up?
Not a single thing. Rural New Mexico can certainly be very similar to rural West Virginia. I suppose that's redundant, isn't it, rural West Virginia? But there just doesn't seem to be anything that I relate to like that. There was a very interesting thing done recently being a couple of years ago, I think, Terry, by the Zuni Pueblo. And the Zunis and some folks from Appalachia got together and compared cultures. And the similarities were astounding between those two cultures, which means that probably there are very similar kinds of circumstances between most of the Pueblo tribes and most areas of Appalachia. But I guess I don't run around looking for that. When I look out my window where I live, I don't even see a house. And I suppose that occurs a lot in West Virginia. But what I do see is certainly not Appalachia. Not that that's good or bad or indifferent. It's just it is different, and that's about the only distinction.
What was it like for you after leaving Appalachia when you started to maybe, you know, read books or news reports about Appalachia? Or maybe when you were introduced to, like, the James Agee book, Let Us Now Praise for Famous Men. What was it called? Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, yeah.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, which is, you know, photographs and essays about the people of Appalachia. And there were the anti-poverty programs and so on. So looking at the poverty in Appalachia from an outsider's point of view, how did it look to you?
Looked awful. I mean, for some of it I didn't understand. I mean, growing up there, when you then leave and you read things about Appalachia, you kind of say, well, that's not what I remember. I mean, it's sort of like you're poor and you're ragged by someone else's standards. Everybody needs a yardstick by which to measure things. And if you've never had any other experiences, if you're born and raised in Crum, 9 out of 10 times, if you haven't been anywhere else, you think it's okay. Well, I didn't think that even though I'd not been anywhere else. And so when I finally got somewhere else and looked back on this by reading someone's article or essay or editorial or whatever it was, I thought, are they talking about us? I mean, gee, I don't remember that. And so it was sort of like people kind of, again, looking down on an area that, frankly, I felt most of them didn't know a damn thing about. And I think they still don't. There's particularly in West Virginia. West Virginia is just plain flat different. And if you're born and raised there, there's this I don't know, I described it in Cannibals as this invisible wire that you're attached to. It can't be cut. And so when you get out here and you look around, and I mean, I can remember denying that I was from West Virginia when I was probably in my 20s. Are you one of them hillbillies, boy? No, not me. Heck no. I was born and raised in Richmond, sir. And now, I mean, after a while, I thought, what in the world is that all about? And it finally dawned on me that I was pretty damn proud of being from back there. So when I read that stuff, even in my 20s and 30s, I would read this stuff, and I thought, these people haven't set foot in that place. I mean, they don't really know what they're writing about. So it was kind of hurtful.
You still have family in Wayne County, West Virginia. How often do you go back?
For a long time, I hardly went back at all. The only family I have left there really is my brother and his wife and kids, whom I adore greatly. For a long time, I simply didn't go back there. But with the republishing of Crum, gosh, I've been back there a couple times a year now for 3 or 4 years. And it's been great fun. I stay out of Crum if I can, but because there's some folks down there that think I'm wearing a target on my back, I guess, but all in good fun. But it's been wonderful, and I really enjoyed going back.
Was it hard to settle down in Santa Fe, where you've been living for about 28 years, did you say?
Yeah.
Was it hard to settle down after trying out so many places, after moving around for so long?
Terry, it is still hard. I've been here all these years, and my wife will tell you that not a day goes by when I do not mention what it might be like to go somewhere else, live somewhere else. What's over the next hill? I mean, it's just, they tell me that the Maynards were originally Scandinavian. I mean, we're talking hundreds of years ago. And I think some of that is still in me, that gosh, you know, give me something that'll float and I'm out of here. And in New Mexico, that's a trick to find something to float it on, actually. But no, there's not a day goes by when I don't wonder and even want to be somewhere else. But apparently it hasn't been as strong as it was in my earlier days.
Lee Maynard, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, believe me.
Lee Maynard is the author of the novel Crumb and the new sequel, Screaming with the Cannibals. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Britney Spears' new CD. This is Fresh Air. Britney Spears has just released a new album called In the Zone, but rock critic Ken Tucker says that putting out music is just a fraction of what Spears does when she makes a new entry into the pop culture world.
Sometimes I just love to have that out. It's just something a girl's gotta do. Never thought I'd see you like this. You're looking good when you're half dressed. Just let me give you one last test. Is that a sin? Am I too hot for you, though?
Over the past couple of weeks, if you turned on the TV or the radio or read a newspaper or a magazine, Britney Spears has been unavoidable. There she was on the American Music Awards in comic book style dominatrix gear. There she was on the cover of Esquire with her bottom showing. There she was in Glamour magazine saying, "I'd love to do a musical because I think singing and acting are my strong points and I'd like to combine them with theater." This is the point at which I'm supposed to ridicule the 21-year-old performer for her unwarranted hubris, to say nothing of her teeny tinny voice. But at this stage of her career, Britney inspires sympathy, a mixture of pity and guarded admiration. Well, not so much that I can summon anything more than dismay at her collaboration on a piece of soft porn with, of all people, the gentle vegan Moby.
All right. I was a little late last night.
Britney Spears, raised in showbiz as a Walt Disney Mouseketeer, seems to exist in the same sort of experience-limiting bubble that Elvis Presley and Michael Jackson have been closed off by. Like Elvis, she's a Southerner whose first instinct is to be polite in interviews and to feel intellectually inferior to her handlers. Like Jackson, she seems trapped in a kind of eternal adolescence. She may have just turned 21, but she still thinks it's daring to be naughty and rebellious. The sad thing is the way she has to announce her outrageousness by, well, by getting R. Kelly to write a song for her that uses that word as its title. Outrageous, when I'm out of my body. Outrageous, when I'm at a party. Outrageous, in my sexy jeans. Outrageous, when I'm on the scene. Outrageous, my sex drive. Outrageous, my shopping spree. Outrageous, we on a world tour. Outrageous, let's be a girl. Sexiest as I wanna be. Got these fellas. Me. Over and I'm on my feet. Gotta keep going. Like TV-centric pop stars from Ricky Nelson to Madonna, Britney is automatically dismissed by serious music fans as a no-talent who gets by on wiggle, sizzle, and not much else. Like Ricky Nelson, who used members of Elvis's crew to give his music a nice sprung rhythm, Britney enlists pros like the Southern rappers the Yin Yang Twins, the production team called The Matrix, and yes, Madonna, to give her music sheen, if not authenticity. And like Madonna, she plays that sex kitten image for all it's worth. And when it's not worth enough, she turns it into a kind of delayed feminism, as on this song, Brave New Girl. She's gonna pack her bag, she's gonna find a way, she's gonna get right out of this. She don't want New York, she don't want LA, she's gonna find her special kiss. She don't want no sleep, she don't want no how. Ooh, like bitches in green. She's gonna wish on stars and touch the sky. You know what I mean? She wants a good life, no need to rewind. She needs to do it when we play what she wants. She lands on both feet, won't take the back seat. There's a brave new world and she's coming out tonight. She's gonna step outside, uncover her eyes. Who knows she could feel so alive. Her MO's changed, she don't wanna behave. Ain't it good to be a brave girl tonight? Tonight, it's alright. A brave girl tonight. So she met this man, he was kinda rough. Did you notice something about that song? It's actually catchy. It works. It's one of the few songs on In the Zone that does. Most of the album is overworked and overproduced. Yeah, she doesn't have much of a voice, but since when was that an impediment to making good pop music? You have to separate technique from effect. And a few times in the past, and a few times on In the Zone, Britney overcomes her own image to provide some musical pleasure. The thing is, that image is as important to her as the music. And unless you're into that zone of aesthetic appreciation, you may miss the small but genuine enjoyments from the Britney Spears publicity machine.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with the 1979 disco hit Good Times by the group Chic. Today we learned that the group's drummer, Tony Thompson, died of renal cancer earlier this month. He was 48.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times chief foreign correspondent John Burns, who was briefly in the States before returning to Iraq. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.